shut up. It's Scotty J here. July 22nd, 2023. You join me, whether you wanted to or not, for another episode, another edition of Scott Speaks. Another crazy week here in the household. Early this week, my dad was in town. He left Tuesday morning. Todd is in was in Arizona for work all week. Apparently, he's got a crazy story, which he's going to regale us with on next week's podcast. So stick around for that, the last podcast of July here on the BroPod Network. But that'll be next week. Of something that happened in Arizona. I don't know. He gave me a brief idea of what it was, but I find it hard to believe, so we're going to see. The wife and I were planning to do a pod today, but we got busy. Got a bunch of stuff going on around the house that we're trying to do. Trying to get the pool going. I believe we've talked about that on a prior episode of The Other Half. We do have an inflatable pool. Which, because of the climate that we live in here in the greater Denver area, is only good for about 60 days every year. But just because it has to be a certain combination of hot and whatever, you guys understand, pools are only good for a certain amount of time. And then this year it's kind of weird because I finally got grass growing in the backyard. And so it's like, well, do I want to put the inflatable pool in the backyard, because then it'll obviously, whatever section it's over, it'll kill that grass, and it's pretty big. I mean, it's the pool's like, I don't know, 10 feet by 6 feet or something. So, you know, we're talking about 60 square feet that will die, of grass that will die. So it's been kind of a puzzling situation this summer, and it didn't get really hot until the last couple of weeks. It was a very, very wet May and June, which I'm sure I've talked about either on an episode of The Other Half or BroPod, Scott and Todd. We're in a weird spot with our pool situation. You know, first world problems, I get it. But so we're probably going to finish that up tomorrow, maybe get it filled up, because the next few days into early next week are supposed to be brutally hot. Like mid to high 90s. And so it's like, hey, let's enjoy the pool. We used it last summer, and the wife and I, as adults, had to find time with it. We were trying to introduce it to our child, and she was just a little young. She just kind of floated there, and we pushed her around. She had a little floaty thing, and, you know, we just kind of pushed her around the pool, and she just moved. So she didn't really get involved with it. But now that she's nearly 18 months old, she's quite the fan of water and splashing around in water. So it feels like this go-around could be quite different with the kid this summer in the pool. So looking forward to trying that out. But anyway, so for all those reasons, it's 10:45 p.m. on a Saturday night, trying to keep the streak alive of uploading a podcast of some sort every week. And so here we are. You get another episode of Scott Speaks, which tends to do quite well on this podcast network. So I don't hate it, but, you know, it's always a little more comfortable doing the show with either the bro or my wife. But in any event, once I kind of realized this was going to be a solo show, I was like, well, but there is a topic that literally only I care about of anyone in my family. I have a coworker, an employee, who could come on and talk at length about this, but wasn't able to set that up because didn't think about this until about an hour ago. But anyway, so the topic tonight on Scott Speaks, if you're hearing a beeping in the background, the laundry is running, so it doesn't surprise me. But anyway, the topic tonight is the tour. Tour de France. Tour de France. The Le Tour de France, I mean, pronounce it however you want. Tour de France is going on right now. Matter of fact, at the time of this recording, in about 8 or 9 hours, the final stage will be starting. And in about 12 to 13 hours, the tour for 2023 will be ending on the Champs-Élysées in Paris, France. The tour is something. So as you're listening to this, I will upload this obviously tonight. But as you're listening to this, unless you get right on it, the tour is probably over. But that's okay. Everything I'm going to say is still very relevant and hopefully entertaining. But the tour is something that I started watching, I want to say in 1998, maybe 1999. So I'm nearing 20, I might be this year, but I'm nearing 25 years of watching the tour. I'm not saying I've caught every minute of every stage in 25 years, but pretty darn close. Probably 85, 90 plus percent. And back in the day, I believe it was on ESPN or ESPN2, they would have, at like midday every day during the tour, they would have like a 30-minute highlight show where they would show you the highlights. And I used to, I would record it on our VCR. Hello. And then I would take those tapes. I was working at a place called Gallman Staffing. I was a staffing assistant, which basically meant in that office that I was the receptionist because it was me and a staffing agent. And we basically placed people either for like office work or for like construction work. And we were one of the satellite offices. So really all we did was on Fridays, people would come in and get a paycheck. And I would hand them their paycheck. That's about it. Occasionally we'd have people that would come in and like do the, you know, kind of an initial interview, if you will, with the staffing agent who was the only other person that worked in my office. But that rarely happened too because we were satellite. We didn't want that to happen. And so I just did light filing and answered phones and whatever. And going total sidebar here, but I remember my first week or so, and I forget who my quote unquote boss's name, what her name was. But anyway, every time the phone rang, I would say, Gallman Staffing. And they'd say, yeah, can I speak to, let's say her name was Christy. I legit don't remember what her name was. I'd say, hold on. And then I'd beep into her and I'd say, hey, Christy, phone's for you. And it took her almost a week to say, hey, Scott, could you ask who it is so that you can beep over to me and tell me, hey, it's so-and-so. That's how little experience I had. And the funny thing is that I got this job because I had interviewed with Gallman personnel, Gallman Staffing, whatever it's called. And I said, yeah, you know, I want an office job and an inside white-collar job, whatever. And literally that same day, they were like, well, actually, and I interviewed at this satellite office. They were like, well, actually, we need somebody here, like starting on Monday or whatever it was, because the person had quit. And I was like, sure, I can do that. So it really worked out well. But anyway, getting away from the point. The point was I would take those VCR tapes, and we had two. So I had the reception area. There was my boss's office. And then there was like an interview room. And then there was like a second smaller room that had one of those combo TV VCRs. And so I would take the tape every day. And during my lunch break, I would go in there and I would, for 3 weeks at least, I would go in there and I'd watch the 30-minute highlights of the tour. And this was early Lance Armstrong days. I don't know if Jan Ulrich was in there. Marco Pantani, like there were some names that, if you followed cycling in the mid to late 90s and early aughts, that would sound familiar as I'm saying them, but I don't think Lance had won. I think the summer that I was doing this, he had not won yet. But anyway, point is, I was watching, that was my introduction to the tour. Obviously, I'd kind of heard of it before, but I was like, whoa, this is pretty cool. And every day, I'd finish my lunch, I'd eject the tape, and I'd take it home and put it in the VCR, and I was just rotating two tapes every single day, which sounds so ridiculous nowadays. But again, this is pre-cell phone. Like, you know, most of the day, during the day, I had a radio and I was just listening to the radio. I played a lot of Freecell. Like, this is, you know, I'm old. Like, this goes back a bit. So that's how we entertained ourselves. But in any event, so that's when I got hooked on it. And then obviously in the early aughts to the mid aughts was when Lance Armstrong was kind of in the midst of his reign, and I watched as much as I could. You know, it used to be on the Olympic Network, and then it was on NBC Sports. It's kind of bounced around the Outdoor Channel maybe for a summer. The coverage has really bounced around a lot, which is frustrating because you can't keep track of where it is. This summer it's on Peacock, although they're airing the re-airs on USA, thankfully, at midnight every night, at least midnight out here, so I'm able to catch it. But, you know, they used to have, when it was on NBC Sports, they'd have the live show, which would start between 5 and 6 a.m. out here. This is more recently. And it could go 4, 5, 6 hours if it was a big mountain stage. Then they'd re-air it at like noon, which was a two-hour version. They'd re-air it at 2 or 3 p.m., which was a 2 or 3 hour version. Then they had the primetime show at 8 p.m., which was always a three-hour version. It had like additional analysis. It's kind of crazy. Now, at least this year, they've only had one version. It's the midnight on USA, unless you have Peacock and you're watching it live. But I don't have Peacock anymore, so I'm not watching it live. But and it's always 4 hours. The last couple stages, as I'm sitting here today, today was stage 20 of 21. The last couple stages, like 17, 18, were 2 hours. One of them was 3 hours. But it's just a lot. Like, I enjoy cycling. I love cycling. I rode my bike today. Went out for a quick 19, 20 miles. It was great. I love it. I really enjoy the sport, whether doing it solo or competitively, whatever, or watching it, watching the, you know, the pros do it. But 4 hours of anything every day, there's two rest days where there's no show at all. And I'm thankful for those breaks because I'm just trying to keep up. And I'm zipping through some of it, you know, because it's like it's just flat road and there's, you know, there's not like, God bless the commentator, there's not much they can say. But in any event, I'm kind of all over the place here. But I really enjoy the tour. You know, much in the way that I watch a lot of track and field, and I was watching track and field earlier today. There was a Diamond League meet that I had on my DVR. You know, it's one of those Olympic, quote-unquote Olympic sports, more on that in a second, that America just doesn't care about, but the rest of the world really cares about. So few Americans care about track and field, except for, like, you know, who's the best 100-meter runner, sometimes who's the best quarter-miler, you know. We have Olympic champions in Olympic medalists in the most recent Olympics in Tokyo in all sorts of events. Shot put, you know, we swept the 100 in the last Olympics, 100 meters for the men, but shot put, hammer throw, like we got a bunch of, you know, really strong field competitors too. And I'm not as much into the field events, but America just doesn't care about that. You know, they want to see guys break 10 seconds in the 100 and then they'll wait 4 more years to see it again. That's not me. And I'm like people in Europe. People in Europe love this shit. They eat it up. They want to see it all the time. And I'm the same way. I want to see it. Why is it not as big a sport here? I don't know, because there's not hitting and pads. Like, it just, it doesn't make sense to me. So I love track and field. Was watching that. And same thing with cycling. Like, cycling, this may sound strange, but is a great spectator sport. The Tour de France covers, you know, several thousand miles, typically over 2,000 miles of a country. And you can go out to the roadside and be right there. Now, why I say it sounds a little strange, a little funny, is true. They're going to zip past you at, you know, 20, 25, if it's downhill, 30, 35 miles an hour. And you're like, oh, that's my favorite guy. I love that guy's my favorite. Really, I love the yellow jersey. And then they all zip by, and then the cars go by, and then it's gone. And you have waited 5 hours to watch that happen. So I get it. However, what other sport can you literally get that close to those people? And if you're at the finishing town or the starting town, you know, they give out autographs. They'll interact with the fans to a degree. So it is a very, the athletes are very approachable and, you know, attainable, I guess, for lack of a better term. Like, you can go up and touch them and talk to them and ask them questions. And yeah, I get it. You could do that at a basketball game or, you know, maybe a football game as they're running out to the tunnel. But these guys don't want to talk to you. They want to get in the tunnel and cash a check. And sure, professional cyclists are cashing a check too, but not nearly as big. Their checks aren't nearly as big. Big part of it, because it costs a lot of money to run a professional cycling team. Not just the cycles themselves, the bikes, but, you know, you got directors of each team, you have huge transportation costs, training costs, masseuses, soigneur. There's a bunch of people behind the scenes that kind of keep that going. And sure, that's true with basketball teams and baseball teams and football teams too. But again, I talk about the accessibility of the athletes. You know, if you're out there watching the Tour de France go by or any cycling race, you're standing there for free. You're not paying for a ticket. So, you know, you're not filling an arena, you're not filling a stadium, that sort of thing. So the economics of it are quite different, but still a very entertaining sport. It's very much a team sport, which should make it more appealing, I would think, to an American audience. Americans tend to like team sports. They like individual sports too, but they really like team sports. It's very much a team sport, more so than really anything I can think of. There's a lot of individual glory, but you only get that glory if you have the help of a team behind you. And it just really is exciting. And again, I mentioned the number of hours. I mean, I'm committing, you know, in terms of recorded video, 75 to 80 hours during the month of July. I'm sure my wife hates it. But, you know, so it is a commitment, but it's entertaining. There's drama. Now, a lot of people will see, you know, headlines and say, oh, well, this guy's been in the yellow jersey. Jonas Vingegaard, for example, is in the yellow jersey right now. He's almost certainly going to win it. Okay, and he's been in the yellow jersey for a couple weeks. Sure. But if you watch the smaller, you know, the micro challenges he's been given and the things he has to do and that his teammates have to do to keep him in that yellow jersey, keep him in that lead for so long. And if you understand it and understand how difficult it is, these mountain climbs they have to do and doing it day in and day out. I mean, you know, they're doing usually 80 to 100 miles a day for 3 weeks with 2 days off. And yes, of course, on those days off, they are still riding their bikes. Like it's insane. If you understand it, again, like I said, I did a 20-mile bike ride today. It was pretty tiring. These guys do 4 to 5 times that every day. Now, they're pros. They're all younger than me. I get it. But still, like, I understand it. I can relate to it. I've never done what they do consistently. I've done a 100-mile ride. I've done those sorts of things. But to do it at that level every single day, it's insane. And you have to respect it. And I think at the end of the day, at the core of it, that's why we watch sports a lot, for a lot of people, not for everyone, but for a lot of people. For me, certainly, I watch track and field because, again, I've never competed at that level, but I love watching distance events in track and field because I've been there. I used to race all throughout high school and you know, I did road races, obviously, for most of my life until the past couple of years. And so I get it. I get what goes into it, the training. You know, day after day, week after week, month, year, I get it. I've done that. Decades of training to try to stay in shape to compete at the highest level. Again, it's not at the level that I'm watching on TV at these Diamond League events or certainly the Tour de France, but I understand it. I understand the grind, and I respect it, and I enjoy it. I really do enjoy it. I like coming home from my bike ride and feeling sore, believe it or not. I know it sounds crazy, but I really do. So I think for me, that's the enjoyment factor. I understand the sport. A lot of people, I think, probably don't understand the sport, but I get it. You know, I've watched enough of it. Like I said, almost, you know, we're right at a quarter century of me watching this sport, and I understand it. And I just have such respect for these guys and what they're out there doing that it makes it really enjoyable. Now, as an American who follows cycling, who watches cycling, and again, let me reiterate, Europe is nuts for cycling. Belgium, Netherlands, France, obviously, you know, countries like that, those are some of their national heroes. I mean, soccer players are still probably near the top of those lists, but, you know, in Belgium, this cycling's the top sport. Like, people love it. You know, people see, you've heard about, whereas in Amsterdam, where there's more bikes than cars on the road. Like, that just wouldn't happen here. Maybe in individual cities in the States, but it wouldn't happen here as a country overall, obviously. I'm not saying anything that's out of left field. But anyway, as an American, I just wanted to touch on something because I know anyone in America, if you talk about Tour de France, you have to talk about what I'm about to talk about. As an American, the most controversial and polarizing figure in cycling is Lance Armstrong. Lance Armstrong, and I'm just going to say this, you can say, well, they were retracted or denied or whatever the term is. Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France 7 years in a row. Now, about a decade later, after winning his last one, after much speculation that he was doping, blood doping, taking out blood, replacing it with fresh blood, with more, you know, oxygen, whatever. I'm not going to get into the scientific details here, but he went on Oprah, which hurts my soul that he chose Oprah, but I get it. Oprah has a reputation. She has a magazine. She is Oprah. He went on Oprah and admitted, yes, I doped. I cheated. Even after years and years and years of saying he did not, becoming a national figure, becoming a national hero, you know, he's a man who overcame testicular cancer and went on to develop the Livestrong Foundation and raise hundreds of millions of dollars for cancer research. Now, did he cheat? Yes, he admitted he cheated. He acknowledged that he cheated. Do I think that the fact that he raised hundreds of millions of dollars for cancer allowed his landing from this controversy and this admission to be a little softer? I do. Do I think it should have? I do. If he was a bad guy and had played the part of a villain this whole time and then acknowledged that he cheated, he just would have been banished and no one would have ever cared what he's ever doing anymore for the rest of his life. And for some people, that's what happened, okay? But my washing machine just finished, so I'm sure you're hearing that in the background. But he admitted his mistakes. He did the full mea culpa, and he's trying to move on. I will say that it kind of bothers me that in the current broadcasts, they talk about the great champions of the past and all this sort of stuff, and it's as if those years don't exist. They talk about the champions before Lance won his seven, and they talk about the champions after Lance won his seven, and that's it. It's as if, and it's probably true, it's as if part of their contract for being commentators is that they cannot mention him by name. And it's just weird because they lauded him. He was a hero. He was an international hero for almost a decade. And they said his name hundreds and hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of times. And then it's as if he never existed. But here's my personal opinion on Lance Armstrong. He's clearly a polarizing figure. It seems like you're kind of on his side or not. I am on his side, and I'll tell you why. Should he have lied over and over again? Should he have been so adamant that he was innocent, that he wasn't blood doping when he knew damn well that he was? No, of course, he should not have done that. That's a given. However, the reason that he explained in his interview where he kind of came clean on all this was kind of twofold. First of all, he'd gotten so deep into saying, I did not do this, that your mind kind of turns off. And it's like, just keep telling that story. There's no way around, you know, you can't back out now. And so you, and we've, I've heard about this. Jamie and I were talking about this not that long ago. Like, you convince yourself that it's true. You convince, he convinced himself that in fact he had not blood doped and that he was innocent and that he was the legitimate winner of seven straight tours. So that's the first thing that I think probably happened. I'm not a psychologist. I can't psychoanalyze anyone, so I don't know that for sure, but that's my suspicion. The second claim that he staked over and over again, which again doesn't make it right, but I do believe was true, is that everyone else was doing it. Now, age-old, you know, example. Well, if everyone else is jumping off a bridge, you're going to do it. Sure, probably not. But in the hyper-competitive world of professional sports, if you know in a field of, in the case of the tour, in a field of, you know, just under 200 competitors, if you know or you feel as though 80% of them, 75%, whatever the number was, are all doing the same thing, and if you don't do that thing, you're going to fall to the back of the pack. But if you do do that thing, you're the best in the world, and you can earn tens of millions of dollars. Again, it's not right. I don't know what I would do if put in that same situation, but I understand why someone would say, well, everyone else is doing it, I'm going to do it. Your team manager is saying, the team is doing this, well, I'm going to do it. Your teammates, who at that point in his career were older than him and were more experienced than him, are saying, yeah, this is just what we do. Well, then I'm going to do it too. And so in that way, again, none of this makes it right, but I understand, to quote Chris Rock. So it kind of bothers me that he is not mentioned in the lore of the tour. And I get it. The tour has separated itself from Lance Armstrong. That's fine. That's fine. But, and he's the one who's fallen on his sword. But he has made the claim, and I have no reason to think it's not true, that winners in years before him and winners in years after him were also blood doping and figured out a way around it. And they just weren't as high profile. And that's why they weren't caught. That's why it wasn't such a big deal. And look, for those that follow cycling, know that in the years that followed, entire teams were thrown off of the tour. One such team, a Spanish team, I can't remember who it was or when it was. I think it was the early teens, 2012, 13, 14, something like that. An entire team was thrown off the tour the day before it started because they were found to have, you know, they were suspicious or found guilty or whatever. The UCI, which is the governing body for kind of determining that sort of stuff, caught them cheating, essentially. And so there was a crackdown on that sort of stuff as a result of Lance Armstrong and the impact that he had on the sport. Now, it's 2023. I'm watching and enjoying the tour. Do I think everyone on the tour is clean? I don't know the answer to that question. Do I think it's highly likely that a very high percentage, perhaps as high as 100%, of the individual riders in this year's tour are clean? I do. I really do. So in a way, as a sort of a martyr, Lance Armstrong has helped to clean up the sport, which legitimizes it, and which you would think helps make it more palatable for the viewers. Interestingly, going back to track and field for a second, and marathon running specifically, there have been several controversies just this year and several bans on various track and field athletes and a marathoner that, for the same reason, they'd taken a steroid. I don't think it was EPO necessarily, which is what Lance was guilty of doing. But, they'd taken an illegal substance, a banned substance. Certainly there's a story of Shikari Richardson, who qualified for the Olympics in between this last Olympics in Tokyo, in between qualifying at the U.S. Olympic trials and the Olympics taking place, she was found to have smoked weed and was kicked off. I don't have time to go into that. I think that's a little silly. Like, how is that enhancing? that would hurt performance, but I'm neither here nor there. You can't talk about the tour to an American audience, which is largely who listens to this podcast, without saying your two cents on Lance Armstrong. Again, without the Livestrong Foundation, without the yellow bracelets, without that sort of impact, would I feel the same way? I don't know. I just don't know. There's no way for me to answer that question. Because he was kind of a cold person. He was a cold interview. He wasn't very gregarious. So he didn't have that to lean on. You know, he was just kind of, he was hyper-competitive. He had that steely demeanor that was like, win at all cost, clearly. And that's the road that he went down. But in any event, he allowed me to stay interested and get interested in the sport. And I'm still interested to this day, even though he's been out of the sport for over a decade. So I do give him credit for that. And it was, for the 2000s, the aughts, America cared about cycling. Still not as much as they should, as much as Europe did, and they certainly don't again anymore. But, it was a boom. It was a boom to that sport in this country, and he was solely responsible for that. So I do give him credit for that. But in any event, tour's going on. It ends tomorrow. It has been an interesting tour. Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogačar have been going head-to-head, throwing haymakers. We had an American in the polka dot jersey, which is the jersey that represents the best climber in the tour. The King of the Mountains is what it's called. He was in that jersey for about 2 weeks out of the 3 week tour. So that was exciting. He eventually lost it just a few days ago, 3 or 4 days ago, in one of the big mountain stages. He just wasn't able to keep up. And now there's an Italian guy that has it, but, it's been a good year. And look, every year, and this is true with any sport like this, which has the individual element, also a team sport. Every year there's going to be young kids that come up and they get a little better, a little better. And 3 or 4 years down the road, whoever's the young kid this year might be in the top three, top five, top 10. And suddenly they're the new contender. It's a short shelf life for these guys. You know, when you're winning the Tour de France or on the podium for the Tour de France, again, not to go back to Lance, he was an exception. Winning it 7 times in a row is crazy. Like, the guy that's going to win it this year, most likely, short of some sort of disaster, it'll be a second time in a row, and he might only have a couple more years, and then you just start to decline. Because it's so, it's such a razor-thin edge to be at the absolute extreme top level of the sport for an extended period of time. There's a window where you have to have the health, you have to be at the top of your game. And again, that sounds redundant, but it's not like, just to compare it to something that most Americans would understand, it's not like you can, start out as a utility infielder and work your way to a permanent spot and then be a slugger for 6, 7, 8 years. And even your twilight years in your late 30s and 40s, just be a pinch hitter or be a designated hitter or whatever. Like, you can't do that in cycling. If you're not the best of the best, at least as far as the tour is concerned, your team isn't going to be, you're not going to be selected for a team that allows you to ride. Like, you have to have a specialty and you have to be an excellent cyclist. And if you're not excellent, you're out. You know, using the basketball analogy, you can't be a guy that rides, the 15th guy on the team. Well, you're still on the team. Well, no. First of all, each team only takes 8 people. And you have to contribute. You have to do something. You're only as strong as your weakest link in the tour. And so it's a very short window of opportunity, I guess is what I'm saying. So that's what I mean when I say these young guys are out there and they'll show up. And a few years down the road, sorry, I'm getting tired. A few years down the road, maybe you'll be in that top 3, top 5. But that time ends quickly. So so it is very interesting. And Jonas, I think, is 28. And his chief competitor, Tadej Pogačar, is He's got to be less than 25 because he's wearing the white jersey. I think he's 24 or 25. He's right there. So, you know, Tade might be the guy in a year or two as Jonas gets a little older. Sounds funny to say. As he hits 30, he's too old to win the tour. But it just takes a lot out of you, you know. It's a tough nut to crack. So if you're not watching it and you're at all interested in cycling or at all interested in endurance sports, I encourage you to watch it. Again, by the time you listen to this, it'll be over for this year. But check it out. Learn the history of the tour, some of the great names of the past. And you really get into it. And it is, it's one big commercial for the Tourism Board of France, for sure, because they're riding all over the place. Mostly, you know, obviously up these big mountains in the Alps and the Pyrenees and spending a lot of time out in the middle of, you know, poppy fields and lavender fields and on kind of country roads. But certainly they go through cities big and small, and it always ends in Paris. You got the Arc de Triomphe, you got all the main landmarks in the city of Paris, the city of love. So if you're into that sort of stuff, that, you know, that could bring in some other people too. I don't care too much about that side of it, but it is pretty cool that, you know, every year they do a different route except for that last day. The last day, it always ends in Paris. It always ends on the Champs-Élysées. So in that way, that's a consistent, that's something you can rely on. But in any event, check out the sport if you haven't. If you don't know anything about it, check it out. It's pretty cool. If you have any questions, let me know. TheBroPodNetwork@gmail.com. Shoot me an email. I'll answer your questions about the tour. But anyway, we'll wrap it up there. Just north of 35 minutes here. So, yeah, that's it for this week on Scott Speaks. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week with a new edition of BroPod with Scott and Todd. Because again, I'm very, very eager to have Todd regale us with the story from his work trip this past week. So can't wait to hear that. But anyway, slide into our DMs on Instagram or Twitter, the_bro_pod. Check us out on our website, bropodnetwork.com, or shoot us an email, as I mentioned, thebropodnetwork@gmail.com. And yeah, that's going to be it for tonight. Hope you guys have a great weekend. Have a great week coming up. And until next time, guys.